Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, July 30th. The United States has now had 150,000 deaths from the coronavirus. We've crossed that threshold. Yesterday alone, there were more than 1,400 deaths officially recorded. The number per day has been going up, not down, this summer. If we assume 1,000 deaths a day going forward, another 150,000 people will die by the end of the year. If the recent rate of increase continues, it will be hundreds of thousands more than that. The U.S. has had the most COVID deaths of any country. We have 4% of the world's population. We've had 25% of the deaths. A group of healthcare professionals from across the country has now published an open letter to America's decision makers calling for the U.S. to shut it down now and start over. That is, non-essential businesses should again be closed. People should stay home, going out only to get food and medicine or to exercise and get fresh air. Sounds like April in New York all over again if we were to do it. They say shut it down and start over and this time do it right. In just a minute, we're going to speak to one of the signatories of the letter to talk about that and other coronavirus news. While we're getting our guest on the line, I'm just going to read you parts of this letter. It's headlined, Shut It Down, Start Over, Do It Right, an open letter to America's decision makers on behalf of health professionals across the country. Dear decision makers, hit the reset button. Of all the nations in the world, we've had the most deaths from COVID-19. At the same time, we're in the midst of, quote, reopening our economy, unquote, exposing more and more people to coronavirus and watching numbers of cases and deaths skyrocket. It says in March, people went home and stayed there for weeks to keep themselves and their neighbors safe. You didn't use the time to set us up to defeat the virus, and then you started to reopen anyway and too quickly. And it goes on from there. With me now is one of the signatories of the letter to talk about that and other coronavirus news. Dr. Krutika Kupali, forgive me, is an infectious diseases physician who has focused on the care of vulnerable patients in the U.S. and abroad, a biosecurity fellow at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security, and vice chair of the Global Health Committee at the Infectious Diseases Society of America, and has been spearheading efforts to prepare and train physicians to handle infectious diseases. Dr. Kupali, we really appreciate your time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Can we talk first about this open letter? Why shut it down and start over?
Sure. The idea is that the first time that we went into lockdown, we didn't use that time appropriately, and we're seeing the effects of that here again now. We're seeing cases go back up again, we're seeing deaths go back up again, and we don't even have the things that we need to do to try and manage the outbreak. We don't have testing readily available, we have a shortage of testing supplies. We're having challenges with PPE again, and now we're seeing those effects on our healthcare systems and our healthcare workers. And so what we really need to do is try to end chains of transmission. And in order to do that, we really need to strongly consider shutting things down again and having a reset on the pandemic response in this country. And that would be trying to get things right again. And that's the reason for this letter.
You know, even cautious science-based governors like Cuomo in New York, as you know, are reopening different parts of the state at different rates, depending on how much local virus is present. Are you calling for not even that, but a blanket national restart?
No, we are not calling for a blanket national restart. What we would want is really to do this in areas where we are seeing high levels of viral transmission. I believe what we said was areas where, you know, transmission have been greater than 5%. And so, you know, really where areas that have been highlighted in the news, right? So places like Texas, Arizona, Florida, South Carolina, California, places where the virus is really running out of control. Here in California, the rate of percent of positivity is 7.5%. In other parts of the country, we're seeing percent positivity of greater than 10%. Those would be the areas we would really be concerned about because, again, we're not able to effectively test right now. Without effective testing, we don't know what's going on. We're essentially running blind. And then on top of that, as we aren't able to break chains of transmission, then we know that these cases are going to continue to propagate on themselves. We know from other studies that have been done, each case generates about 10 to 25 contacts. And so we're not able to appropriately contact trace either. So without breaking these chains of transmission, things are going to continually get worse.
Being a Californian, what's your take on what happened in California, which originally shut down earlier than New York and was doing so much better than New York, and there was no ideological opposition to shutting down as there is in some states. So what happened in California?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I think it's an important situation for all of us to understand. I think, first of all, people need to understand that the situation in California is not uniform throughout the state. There are a number of different things going on, and you are absolutely right. We were the first state to shut down, and people went home. They stayed at home and did everything that they were asked to do. And I believe that, you know, as we started to come out of lockdown, a couple of things happened. One, first of all, people started to feel, hey, we got this and we're doing great. And there was a sense of that we beat it. And so then people started to do the things that they maybe shouldn't have done. That was one problem. Secondly, if you look at areas where the outbreak is not doing well, a lot of those areas are in Central and Southern California, particularly LA County. And those are areas where there is a lot of high population density. And as we know, the outbreak tends to like areas where there's high population density. That's one of the second things. I think the third thing that people need to understand is that in California, the outbreak is highly concentrated, or a majority of the infections are in our vulnerable patient populations and in our Latinx community. So over 56% of infections are in Latinx populations, and I believe over 50% of fatalities are in Latinos. And that's really important to understand because those are the people that make up the backbone of our community here in California. Those are our essential workers. Those are the people who are going out and working because they have to. They don't have the luxury of staying at home. And those are the people we need to protect. But those are also maybe the people who don't have as good access to things like texting and being able to self-isolate. So we need to figure out ways to expand access for those types of population. Two other things that have been problematic here in California is that there have been large outbreaks in some of our prison systems. San Quentin, who's one of our largest prison systems here in California, has suffered a horrible outbreak with over half of the prisoners infected. And finally, now in Central California, which is where we do a lot of agriculture, has been very hardly hit. If you work in agriculture, again, that's largely immigrant populations, minority populations, and very difficult for those people to physically distance. Very hard to wear a mask when it's 100 plus degrees outside. We need to find a way to take care of those populations because those are the people that we depend upon in our society. So it's a very complicated situation here.
Yeah, those are very interesting specifics that you gave. I'm curious about one thing regarding the agricultural workers, since being outdoors is considered generally so protective. What is it about their situation? Is it the way they're housed at the end of the day, especially the migrant farm workers, or do you know?
You know, that's not an area that I'm particularly an expert in. I think that there are probably a number of things that they need to look at, right? So I would say that from what I know about the situation, there's a concern that that could be part of it. Again, when they are working, even though they are outdoors, they are close with each other working in the fields. And so that is that would be one concern. I think the other thing is that a large number of these people are probably undocumented immigrants. And so even if they were to get sick, concerns about being able to access care.
How do you view the 1,400 deaths yesterday nationwide in the context of the open letter that you signed to shut it down and start over? You know, people who want to keep reopening going argue that it's barely more deaths, even though, oh my God, 1,400 deaths in one day. And imagine this going on day by day by day by day, and not to be numb to that in any way. And yet people who want to keep reopening going argue that it's barely more deaths than New York alone had at its peak in April, when shutting down was definitely called for. So the bigger picture, they say, is that the news spread is mostly among younger people who are getting it and recovering. The hospitals are not stressed. They are stressed, but they're not overwhelmed. And so given the economic and public health consequences of shutdowns, you saw the number out this morning, probably the U.S. economy contracted by fully one third in the last 3 months. Nothing like that has ever happened. And that has disparate public health consequences, too, by race and class. So given all that, the other side of this argument says the smarter thing to do is to close bars and other indoor gathering places and encourage or require masks and physical distancing, but not just shut down and make everybody stay home. So what do you think of that approach that some places are now taking?
So first of all, what I'm going to say right now is that any death from coronavirus should be concerning, let alone over 1,400. This is, at this point, any death that we're seeing makes my heart break. These are things that are preventable. These are things that should not be happening. We are now in the end of July. We are 6 months after the WHO declared a public health emergency of international concern. That is the highest level of alarm that WHO can declare. And they declared that at the end of January of this year. There's no reason that we should be seeing what we're seeing right now, but yet we are. So anything that we see, like what we saw yesterday, I find disheartening. And I think that we need to not let this become part of our everyday life where we say that this is routine. This is not routine. And the healthcare systems are becoming overwhelmed. And I can tell you from personal experience and from talking to friends and colleagues all over the country that have been working in this since January, February, that they are becoming tired. And we only have a finite number of healthcare workers. And there's only so long that they can continue to do this. And at a certain point, this is going to also take a toll on them. And typically in a disaster, you would be able to pull from other parts of the country or other parts of the world. We don't have that luxury in this situation.
Todd in Bedford, New York. You're on WNYC with Dr. Kripalu. Hi, Todd.
Hi, how are you? I had a quick question about education. In your estimation, what is the best way to go about getting kids educated in light of this situation? We're approaching a school year. There's lots of plans being floated in my area, and I'm not sure what would be safe and what would not be safe. What would, in your opinion, be the least risky way to go about educating children right now?
Yeah, that's another hot button topic right now. And I think that there are a number of things you need to think about. So first off, depending on what part of the country you're in, you really need to understand what's going on with transmission in regards to COVID-19. So if there's, you know, high rates of transmission going on in your community and it doesn't look like things are being well controlled, I don't think sending your child to school would be the optimal idea. It does look like from data that's coming out that children less than 10 don't seem to transmit infection very much. So it does seem in that age population, that's a quote-unquote safer population to try and send back to school. However, you know, there are things that need to be thought about, right? You need to look at things like, what is the school's plan for physical distancing? What is the school's plan for making sure that teachers are protected and administrators are protected and things like that? We don't want to send kids to school without a comprehensive plan, because let's say they do get a teacher sick. Imagine the mental health effect on a child. So we need to think about things like that. I think that we also need to think about how kids will be cohorted, right? Because we want to try and keep kids together and not have them exposed to lots of other different kids. So it is a very complicated situation. And ideally, the administrators and the parents and the teachers are all working together in the community to come up with a plan. And I think it's important also to really consider the various options of combinations of in-class and at-home learning. That seems to be what is most likely going to happen. But ultimately, the decisions need to be driven by what's going on in your community.
Dr. Kapali, I see you can comment on some of what's happening with the virus in pro sports. And my question about that is not about sports themselves, but whether there are lessons to be learned for regular workplaces from the methods they're trying. Like, Major League Baseball players get tested every other day. Some individual players have gotten quarantined until they test negative, and their teams have not suffered group outbreaks. The only team that has is the Miami Marlins, and the suspicion there is some of the players broke the behavior rules and went to crowded bars last week, and then the virus exploded in the group. I don't know that that's been proven, but that's the suspicion. My question is it a model for the rest of us to do something like get tested every other day with at-home tests once they're available, and then play by the masking and social distancing rules, and then we can go back to something more like normal?
I think those are great questions. Yes, I think that there are definitely things to be learned from what Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA, what they're doing. I think that the challenge is how do we apply those things to everyday life and make them realistic, right? You know, the NBA living in kind of a bubble, how realistic is that? So trying to figure out how we can do that. I think the frequent testing, yes, we definitely need to do those types of things. And that's part of the reason, again, for this, this going back to the letter that we wrote, right? We don't have those capacities, right? We're not even at the capacity we need to be at for just to be able to test the people who are sick, let alone to be able to test the people who might need surveillance testing. And so that's why trying to do some of these things makes it difficult. And so I think trying to figure out a way to get children tested, to get adults tested who are in these types of situations, and then keep them in kind of what we're calling these pod type situations where they all are going to school together, maybe if they're doing sports together, right? So then if one person gets sick, you're not taking out a whole bunch of people. I think those types of things make sense.
Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'm calling to tell your doctor that if there is a generalized lockdown again here, I'm not going to comply. I've been very rigorous with masking, social distancing, hand washing, and that sort of thing, and I will continue to do so. But high-risk population, she's talking about, send them a check and keep them home. Send them some money, keep them home. People like me who got this $1,200 check should not be getting that money. I still have my job. That money should go to people who can't, protect themselves for whatever reason. And I simply will not participate in the generalized lockdown. I will break it. I'll go to jail if I have to. I will participate in protests against it. I'm done with this. Done. Keep people home who are high risk. Send them a check. They're good at doing that in New York, for instance. And that's it.
Doctor, now
take any responsibility there. Thank you.
Jim, thank you. Well,
I guess the one, the one thing I would like to say is it's actually not the older people that are the highest demographic getting infected right now. It's the younger group, right? The 18 to 49 year olds that
right,
are actually the ones getting infected right now.
But he means at high risk of really serious effects.
Sure, sure. I understand that. But actually, the people we're seeing in the hospitals right now are the people in the 18 to 49-year-old group. Those are the people we're getting in.
Is that right? You want to talk about that? Yeah. Elaborate on that? That's going to be news to a lot of people.
Well, I think that we're, if you look in, so I can speak to California, right? The people who have the greatest number of infection right now are the 18 to 49-year-old population, right? And so that is a problem. That is a concern, right? But those people will eventually, those people who are positive, that will go on to the risk group that we are worried about having the greatest adverse effects, right? So we need to, again, think about this as a community type of disease. And we need to think about what I do affects everybody. And I think people need to hopefully at some point realize that. So even if your caller doesn't want to comply with a lockdown, that will, what they do affects other people. And that's the thought process.
Dr. Krutika Karpali, infectious diseases physician who is focused on the care of vulnerable patients in the U.S. and abroad. She is a biosecurity fellow at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security and vice chair of the Global Health Committee at the Infectious Diseases Society of America, and she has been spearheading efforts to prepare and train physicians to handle infectious diseases. Dr. Karpali, thank you for all your knowledge and insights today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.